This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for May 11th, 2015. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. I'm Drew Messenger Michaels. Thanks as always for being here. So, this week, as I mentioned last week, I am talking to Roel Eisendam of Rage Squid Games. Their game Action Hank is out of early access and released for real today. I mispronounced his name in the last episode, and I'll probably mispronounce it many times in the interview. I think last week I said it more like Roll than Rule, but it's more like Rule than Roll. But anyway, his name is Roel Eisendam, and I'm sure I'm still butchering it, and he's a really, really fascinating guy. He talks very openly and very often, albeit mostly in Dutch, about the hard science, that science mostly being physics or simulated physics, of making a character feel good to control, which is a really squishy but really important concept in games, obviously, right? And he's a guy who can break that concept down both in a technical and in a non-technical way. And I think that combination, as I say to him, of being able to implement those sorts of techniques and being able to explain them, both to, you know, fellow experts and to laymen, such as myself, is really rare. The fact that he can communicate it and do it, that he can teach it and execute it, makes him a guy very much worth talking to. And also, not coincidentally, means that Action Hank is a very, very special experience. It's a game really just about momentum and perfectionism. It's a game where you just run right to the right, usually, very, very quickly, and you try and perfect your time. You perfect the techniques of when you should be running and when you should be jumping and when you should be butt sliding and all those kinds of things, and just get it as right as you can. It's a game about the sheer joy of moving a character through space like a toy, as Roel says. Rule. More like rule than rule. Anyway, so that's what this is about. It's a great conversation. One quick note on audio quality. Something's up with my computer. My gaming machine is on its way out, I suppose. Could be the processor, could be the graphics card. I'm not totally sure, but it's making a noise. So you'll hear that at some points in this interview. I'm right now recording on my MacBook, which I'll probably be doing in the future. Anyway, apologies if that annoys anybody, but it shouldn't be too bad. Anyway, without any further preamble, here is... Let me try this one more time now. I'm going to get it right, I swear. This is... Who lays in them?
Can you hear me properly? Is everything clearly audible?
Yeah, you're quite audible. I would say proper even.
Oh wow, that's great. So I guess it's good morning for you.
It is, and I believe it's good afternoon for you. Yeah.
Yeah. It's. It's 5 o'clock here now, so...
Yeah. My day job is actually with a software company based in Munich, so I'm very familiar with this particular time difference. I'm in Chicago, they're in Munich, so it's, you have like a very narrow band of day that are officially working hours for all concerned.
Yeah, exactly. It's always like early in the morning for you, and then late in the afternoon for them.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's nothing like working with India, though, right? Because, like, at that point, there are no good hours for anybody ever, you know?
We had
colleagues who were on the West Coast of the U.S. and had to work with some Indian developers, and it was just a mess, you know?
So how do you, like, what do you do then? What would be the best time?
The best time usually ends up being late evening on the West Coast, which is legit the middle of the night in India. And it's just, I don't know, business culture over there is such, I suppose, that that's expected. That, event, you know, sooner or later you're going to be on a 2 a.m. call, be ready for it, you know?
Whoa, really? Okay. Well, that's hardcore.
It's really, hardcore would be the word I would use to describe Indian business culture in one word, probably. I mean, because they work like 8-day, you know, stretches and things like that. And
damn.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy.
All right, cool. So, can you tell me a bit about the podcast? Because I didn't have much time to like look it all up.
Oh yeah, totally. So basically, I did a master's at UChicago a couple of years ago, right before they started seriously letting people study games, basically. Like, it was around the time that there were a few classes, so I kind of cobbled together a thesis on how you apply, like, art history and film theory and literary theory and all kinds of stuff to games. And since then, I've been keeping a blog and doing a podcast that's kind of followed by the, you know, the community of nerds around there that I met there and that, you know, I've met since, where I just kind of like talk mostly to game developers, but not exclusively, just about everything, right? Just about making things and what interests them and, you know, particularly where games are going. That's maybe the most interesting thing to me is the burgeoning of this medium. Like, it's almost like early film, where there are no rules or the rules are still being written, and it has a lot to say about where the world is and where tech culture is and where, you know, artistic expression is and technology and all that. So to me, games are the nexus of all that. And the podcast is basically me talking, again, mostly to game developers about that.
All right. Well, that, I mean, sounds good. I guess you got in contact with Kitty, right?
I did, yeah.
She set everything up.
She did. She hooked me up with a code. I've been really, really enjoying the game.
Oh, that's great. Cool.
I have not yet beaten all of the Hard as Hank levels, but I will. I mean, that's going to happen, clearly.
All right. Have you earned a rainbow medal yet?
I earned a rainbow medal in the first, world or the first section.
Wow, okay. That's nice. Okay, so I see you, you put some time in it, apparently.
I did. Well, it's also in these kind of games are my jam, and I guess by these kind of games, I mean platformers generally, 2D platformers specifically, and anything involving momentum more specifically. I have always enjoyed that. I mean, like, I devoured Super Meat Boy, and I loved, you know, I mean, like, going back to Super Mario Brothers, right? Like, there's been a lot written, obviously, about, what sometimes gets called sticky friction in that game, and how just the way Mario moves is kind of why you love it, over and above any kind of aesthetic or, you know, the really nice music and all that. That is the main hook, and so I've been hooked on that, you know, since the mid-80s when I was a little kid.
Yeah, I see. Well, I definitely agree on the, like, the platformer and the sort of hardcore and everything involving physics or momentum. It's definitely, I mean, that's why I ended up programming the game the way it is, because I just really enjoy physics-based stuff.
Yeah, and I guess I especially enjoy good video game physics applied to platformers, because when someone talks about a physics-based puzzler, I sometimes tend to cringe a little bit, because what it sounds like is, like, I'm going to be playing Jenga, basically. You know, there's going to be this huge element of chaos. I'm going to have to line stuff up awkwardly. Like, you know, you replay Half-Life 2 now, and you think, it's really, really cool that I can, like, you know, put, you know, I can balance some cinder blocks on this thing and make a seesaw, but I don't actually want to do that, and it's kind of finicky, and, like, what's actually the challenge there? It's more like a tech demo. Whereas, with a really consummate physics platformer, it tends to be, or specifically something where it's about the momentum of your character and not balancing shit on a seesaw, right? It's really satisfying, because you feel like you have complete control over the system, you know, and over the simulation. I don't know if maybe that's what's appealing about it to you, because I know I've seen your talks, and I know you futzed with the physics of the characters a lot in this game.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I know the Dust Force developers talked a lot about how there's no point in designing levels or anything else if it's not fun just to kind of make the character move forward and jump and stuff, you know?
Oh, that's, like, I agree. I totally agree on that part. And that's also how we, you know, how we designed the whole thing. Just when I started making the physics, I was just, you know, screwing around. And when I, you know, started to have good fun just, you know, messing around, then I started making levels, because... yeah, it needs to be, you know, the sort of the toy, as you could call it, you know, the sort of the whole act of moving around. If it just, you know, if it's already fun, even without a level, then you know that you got a good sort of foundation to build this entire game upon.
Yeah, and, like, that metaphor, that's interesting that you call it the toy, right? Because obviously the characters in the game are toys. And to me, that's kind of an interesting metaphor, you know, visually speaking and aesthetically, the toy versus the game. Like, the character is the toy, and then the circumstances in which you're expected to play with it are the game. And like you say, Action Hank works because the toy itself is fun to manipulate.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, that's, but it seems to be the thing in all these games. If you look at, you know, good games, or especially if you look at games that are not good, you can really boil it down to, you know, if the simple act of, you know, just moving around, if that doesn't feel right, then you can slap as much content and you can put anything on top that you want. But, you know, if just if just walking around is not nice to do, then yeah, well, it's not going
to
work.
Yeah, yeah, you're building a tower on a shaky foundation. I maybe have that to a fault, you know, because, like, in my own taste in games, because I can definitely appreciate games that are fully hands-off, where it's strategic or almost spreadsheet-based. Like, I like really heavy story games and even visual novels and stuff. I like XCOM. I like Crusader Kings 2 and games that are fully, you know, about menus and clicking and turns. But if I'm going to be moving an avatar around, I want to be responsible for everything that happens. Like, it's really hard for me to get into, like, Blizzard's style of games where, you know, whether you're attacking someone is based on whether you're sort of standing near them, you know, as opposed to...
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, I guess it depends. I can definitely enjoy... I would say I can enjoy all kinds of games, but... When there's moving involved, then yeah, it has to be very, you know, well done.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. So what are your, the Sonic influence is obvious, you know, to the point that, you know, the early access folks got a pretty sweet Sonic costume for Hank. But aside from the Sonic games, what sort of drove you to want to make a game in this style? You know, the loop-de-loops make the Sonic reference obvious, but there's more going on in there.
So first of all, I think Sonic is not necessarily a very big influence, maybe in a sort of subconscious way. I definitely played, you know, some Sonic when I was younger, but it's more like people started comparing it to Sonic, and that's when we saw, like, oh wait, yeah, it's actually a lot like Sonic. But for us, the most prominent influence would be the Trials series. That's definitely like the number one influence for us, because it's just just the way, you know, the whole thing is physics based. You have these short levels, you have to beat your time, and there's all these subtle tricks that you can do to increase your score, or, you know, to decrease your time. And one other very important aspect is that the fact that you basically all the skills that you have to possess throughout the game, you get them from the start, and you actually become better at them. So rather than the game sort of handing you skills, like, oh, now you can jump higher, or now there's this ability that you can do, it's just like, okay, you can do everything you can do throughout the whole game. You can do it from the very first second, and the game itself is about getting better at those skills. So and that works really well with physics-based games, because there's sort of an aspect of, well, seeming like randomness, or, you know, you're not able to control that in the beginning because you have no clue what's going on. And as you go further and further on in the game, you start realizing you can do all these little tricks and these more subtle control things. And then when you get back to the earlier levels, you realize that you actually became better at the game, rather than just, you know, the game increasing stat points for you. And that's something I personally definitely enjoy, and that's something we wanted to, you know, bring forward in Action Hank as well. That you basically, nothing in terms of, you know, gameplay and abilities and stats, nothing changes throughout the game. It's just your personal skill that gets better.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, when I realized I had the Sonic costume, I slapped it on and I was like, oh, I must be faster now. And then I was like, wait, no, this isn't that kind of game. Like, it's in my head. You know, it reminded me of that thing that Ben Kuchera said, I think it was, about how Spelunky has a robust leveling and progression system, but it's all in the player's heart. You know, that's where it exists.
Yeah, it's the games that I love to play and, you know, make as well.
Yeah, so Trials is a really interesting touch point, and it's also very interesting that the Sonic influence came after you'd started working on it, because I definitely, you know, when I go back and play the Sonic games, you know, as a guy who loves momentum, like, let's go with the very first one, right? You play Green Hill Zone, and it's really based upon momentum, and there's a lot of multiple paths. You're flying through the air, you're underground, it's really satisfying. Then you get to, what's it called, Marble something or other zone, and you're, like, waiting for platforms to go down slowly, and it's, like, it's not very well suited to the way Sonic moves, you know? It's trying to do all this stuff that isn't based around the toy. So in that sense, Action Hank is a lot purer than, you know, than those early experiments in making something really, really fast and momentum-based.
Yeah, it's definitely a big difference. That's why I guess that it starts making more sense. It just somehow feels that people think of Sonic games as if they are a lot like Action Hank, even though once you get around to actually playing them, you realize that there's so much more stuff in Sonic games that doesn't have to do with just running fast. So So which, you know, it's definitely a very different game. Also, you know, there's no enemies. There's no, we try to not make you bump into things. We try to just have everything. We try to make it more like a racing game where it's just about, you know, traversing the track in the most optimal way rather than, you know, just constantly having to stop for, I mean, how weird would it be if you have a racing game and you would have to stop for an enemy to, you know, cross by or for a platform to, you know, appear. That would just feel really weird because you're like, I want to race as fast as possible. I don't want to stop. So so that's definitely something that we want to feel. And in that sense, the game is completely different from how, you know, an ordinary Sonic game would play.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and it's like even in racing games where there is chaos and there are things that stop you, the pleasure is in avoiding or overcoming those things. I'm thinking about Mario Kart or something like that. Something that's a little bit more gonzo and crazy. When you get hit with that shell, it's devastating, and when you bounce back, it's exhilarating. It's the joy is not in waiting for stuff, ever.
Yeah, exactly. The joy is not in waiting for stuff, no.
Yeah, yeah, the corollary to, Edmund McMillen, I think, said when Super Meat Boy came out, like, that the core of Super Meat Boy is just that it feels good to do shit fast. And that's really all there is to it at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no. So just, you know, coming back to the question, I'm thinking of other references or like inspirations. I think, I don't know if you've played Trackmania.
I haven't played Trackmania, no.
Do you know about the game, what it is?
I've heard about it. Yeah, I've been meaning to try it, but I have not tried it.
It was like Trackmania Nations is, I think, like a free version of the game. And it was this, it used to be really big. I'm not sure if it's still big or you know, I guess still a lot of people play it. But that's also, it's a racing game, but it's also about these short levels. And you just sort of, you try to perfect your time. You race against, you know, like a bronze, a silver, and a gold medal. However, in Trackmania, there's also this really big online, like, community aspect where people can create their own levels and share them and play them against each other. And we also want to bring that to Action Hank. So the version you're playing right now does not have the online multiplayer enabled yet. We did do some testing with it earlier, like a couple months ago. And when the game is fine, like doing the final launch, we want to, you know, re-enable the whole online multiplayer. And we want people to be able to make their own levels, which is already possible right now. There is a level editor in there. And we want people to be able to, you know, challenge each other on their own levels and play, you know, simultaneously through these levels.
That would be amazing. Because, I mean, obviously Ghosts offer sort of an asynchronous version of that same idea. But to me, it's always innately more satisfying to compete with somebody in real time, you know, like,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
and in fact, like I was saying, I have one shiny rainbow medal and, you know, a bunch of gold and more silver and you know, some bronze and all that. There was no possibility that I was going to get those medals until I started racing against the better ghosts. Like, if I'm racing against the bronze ghosts, I'm never gonna get a gold because I don't feel like I'm getting pushed. But if you if you race against that highest ghost, that has a funny way of making you A, up your game, but also B, see where the ins are, see where it's really important to maintain momentum and what parts of the track you should just be jumping over and all that stuff. So like that kind of, I guess, collaboration, you'd almost call it, is a really key part of the game for me.
Yeah, it's funny because the problem of like how to explain these mechanics to your players is a very tricky one because, you know, you have all these, like I said, the core of the game is super simple. It's just running and sliding and jumping. That's about it. But there's all these different types of tracks that provide different, you know, sort of optimal paths, but you don't know what to do early on in the game. So for us, the challenge is to, in a subtle way, introduce the players to these new mechanics or tricks they can do. For example, if there's like an angled surface, you don't want to run into the angled surface. You want to jump right before it so that you're, you know, you already have upwards momentum. So there's less impact. So you lose less velocity. But yeah, how do you, you know, how do you explain this to a player without pausing the game and having them read, you know, a whole screen full of text?
Yeah, well, and also, I don't know that a screen full of text would even work. You know,
no,
like if you it would be like reading a physics textbook almost, you know, it makes way more sense to, what I like about this kind of game is that it always makes more sense to learn it just by doing it and failing horribly and falling onto the floor, which is hot lava and all that, than to read a wall of text.
Yeah, no, exactly. So the levels try to explain you these things by sort of forcing certain situations to happen so that you are basically, like, the way the level is built, it forces you to do a certain move that you would otherwise not use if you didn't know you could do it. So, and then the other thing is obviously the ghost as well. If you race against ghosts, especially if you race against faster ghosts, you just, first of all, like you said, you get pushed more because you have a very clear opponent. But also you can see all the little tricks that he does, where it's like, oh, I see he jumps over here instead of over there. And then when you try it as well, you realize, oh, this is actually faster. So the ghosts not only serve as a challenge, but also as a way to introduce certain mechanics to the players.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So is the plan in future updates for there to be more authored levels, or is the focus from this point out mostly on giving creation tools to players and then, you know, adding back in the or refining the multiplayer aspect? Because there's already a relatively beefy number of levels, but I, of course, am greedy and could play double that number.
All right, so there will be more.
Good, cool.
I can already see that right now. So I think the early access version has about 7 batches with 7 levels right now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we are basically wrapping up the game right now, and the sort of final, like, early access update, we already did it a while ago, and right now we're just sort of wrapping up all the things, and the final game is gonna have a very different second part of the campaign, and the second part will be sort of in an outside area on an island and on a beach, and there's going to be like a whole different visual style, but the total game will have about 70 levels, so that's definitely like a good 20 new levels when we do the final launch. Together, you know, together with this online multiplayer aspect as well, so there's a whole bunch of stuff that we're just sort of getting ready to do on the final launch.
Great. Yeah, and I wasn't trying to get you to do a sales pitch for how much content it's going to have, because I think that's actually kind of a misguided way to judge a game's value. You know, it's something we do a lot.
Yeah.
That is maybe not the right thing. I asked it because I had a couple of friends who've been playing the early access version and wanted me to ask you, because they are, I guess, greedy like I am. So thanks for answering that.
So I can already tell I don't know if you've had a chance at trying out the ultimate test level, the last level in the game.
I haven't. I just got back from being abroad, so I haven't had a chance to yet. I'm excited to.
All right. So this ultimate test level is very hard, and in the final version there will be basically a whole, you know, batch of levels as sort of a bonus. Like, okay, the game is basically done now, but if you really want some really tough challenges, then go ahead and here's a bunch of very insanely hard levels.
It's the Grandmaster Galaxy or whatever of
Yeah, it's basically like it's sort of the part where, you know, like the story of Hank is that he wants to live up to the name that he used to have when he was younger, when, like, back in the 90s, he was this very cool, you know, like, muscular action figure, and now he's sort of, you know, he kind of let himself go a bit, and then in this final area, like this final stage or like final zone, you basically, in the end, you race against your former self to prove that you still got it, to prove that you still got what you had back in the days.
See, I kind of love that, not just on, you know, basic conceptual, like, you know, facing off with your dark self in the tree, you know, not just that aspect, but the idea that Action Hank kind of feels to me, like, playing it feels the way I remember playing Sonic feeling. Does that make sense? You go back and play Sonic the Hedgehog and it doesn't really feel the way you remember it.
Yeah.
But that feeling that you remember having as a kid, you actually can recover by playing Action Hank. So the idea of racing against your idealized 90s self and eventually kicking his ass is really appealing, you know, on a meta-textual or whatever level.
Yeah, I see. Well, that's cool. I think nostalgia is a very important part of the whole, like, the whole philosophy of Action Hank, and that's why there's also all these sort of subtle or sometimes not so subtle references to nostalgic toys and to, you know, things from our childhood. I think a big difference, though, is that, I mean, there's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of, like, retro stuff in games, but they tend to reference video games in a nostalgic way. So that's also why you have all the, you know, like the pixel art and the 8-bit music and all that kind of stuff. But we specifically said, like, let's not really focus on the old school video games, but on the toys of our childhood. So more like the physical aspect of it. And that's what you can definitely see in this sort of kids room. And you look around, you see all these toys that we used to have when we were a kid. And the best thing for us, if we can have someone else see them and be like, oh, I totally had that when I was younger. That's the best for us. If people like actually feel this sort of nostalgic vibe, that's the most sort of important thing for us.
Yeah, it's again, I mean, not to keep trying to make everything symbolic in a way perhaps you didn't intend, but it kind of resonated with me in that you're steeped in all of these nostalgic physical objects, and you're playing as a character who is supposed to be a physical object and has a lot of physical reality to him because of the physics of the game. It was really, it seemed to me to have something to say about how we think about games as stuff. You know, not as these things that live in our heads or these challenges or anything as abstract as all that, but just as things. You know, I look at my Steam library and how ridiculously unmanageably large it's gotten, and just the idea of accruing games as accruing stuff and collecting games and just games as things seem to be like Hank is kind of like a celebration of that, but also a way of saying there's more to it than that, right? Like there's a joy in nostalgia, but there's also a joy in I don't know, in something new, in just going fast. Like it's interesting to me that you said it in a child's room, you know, as though, you know, it's like Toy Story, but instead of sitting around being mopey or going on adventures outside of the room, the toys have made the room into a game, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's well, I think there's definitely some sort of more subtle, deeper meanings, but there's not, like, we don't really intend to be all like, you know, preachy, or we don't want to put that sure. in your face. I mean, there's definitely, like, we put some thought in this whole sort of universe where this all plays out. And there's certain things that we specifically did not explain to the player, in it, like the sort of what the room, like, whose room is it? It can be all kinds of, it's sort of open to the player to feel like, oh, this feels like it could be my room, or it could be my room when I was younger, or it's like, that's open to the player. And I think, I mean, obviously it's really cool if the game makes people think about these things, but it's not a necessity. And I mean, it's just also a game that you can just simply enjoy, and it doesn't have to be complicated at all.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I meant about by resonant. You know, if you don't want to think about that stuff at all, then it's just a good aesthetic to look at. It doesn't get in the way of the core gameplay. But if you are sort of attuned to that stuff, and if you're a child of the 90s, then there's a lot to take in there, and it is, I think, pretty effective. Yeah, and it's funny. I had assumed it was a child's room. It could, of course, also absolutely be the room of an adult's house that is devoted to collecting nostalgic stuff, right? That hadn't even occurred to me, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, that's up to the players.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I like that it doesn't really explain too much the relationships between the characters, right? That's for you to. It reminded me a lot of playing with action figures, and like whatever it said on the back of the box, you know, it was always my story to make up, which is what was cool about it as a kid. So I think you captured that pretty well.
Yeah. So with the final launch of the game, we do intend on adding a little bit more sort of storyline to the game. It's all very light. There's no like heavy stuff going on, or there's no very like deep storyline, but we do intend to sort of, the idea that we have, what would be the relationships between the character, we do want to sort of make them a bit more clear using some sort of like subtle cutscenes or sort of storyline messages, but we still want it to be pretty light, and we like it if people can sort of find their own meaning in the story. And the funny thing is though that if you look at what we have now, which is just a bunch of characters and there's no sort of explanation whatsoever, we still see that people, when they sort of take a guess at what the sort of story would be, that they actually come pretty close at what we intended for the story to be. So it's funny, like it already sort of works out the way it is, even though it's all like there's no actual story in there as of now.
Yeah, I think that stuff can actually be more effective. I mean, it's the same thing as how learning the physics of a game, you know, is more effective if you just lay hands on it than if you read a wall of text. Similarly, getting a flavor for the world, you know, as opposed to a plot or whatever, but just understanding characters or deciding where you are or something like that can be way more effective by just diving into it. You know, that to me is a little bit more interesting as a way for games to tell their stories or convey their narratives, again, as opposed to plot, than just telling you where you are.
And it's also easier. I mean, I think it's also, I mean, you can put so much work in all this stuff, but then if it's not really clear, if it's just like, yeah, you know, then it's a waste of all this work, and it's way better if you just sort of, do it a bit more subtle and then leave some stuff open for the players to interpret themselves.
Totally. If it hinges on the player noticing the guitar in the background and what make and model it is, then that's a pretty risky move. Whereas just if that's detail and it's there for people who played guitar when they were kids or in the 90s or whenever, and not for those who didn't, and that's that, then that's probably a broader and more ultimately more likely to be effective sort of a technique.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm sure you've been kind of knee-deep in the game of late, but have you been playing anything else? Is there stuff that you kind of dip into playing or reading or listening to or watching or whatever? Is there something you go to kind of recharge or for inspiration or just because you love it even when you're busy?
So I think as of late, there's sort of two games that I play like sort of several times. And they're both like local multiplayer games because it's just, you know, it's like Friday evening at the office and you just want to sort of, you know, hang out, play a couple of games. And I really enjoy the sort of social interaction during games. So one of them is, it's actually done by another developer from the Netherlands. It's called Lethal League. I don't know if you know that one.
Yeah. I really, really like Lethal League. I've had a lot of fun with that game.
I'm a very big fanboy of that game. So I love to play that on like the Fridays, you know, just, you know, grab a beer and, you know, just, you know, play some Lethal League. You know, mess around. And then there's this other game that I just got into playing like about a week ago, and it's Gang Beasts.
Yeah, Gang Beasts. Oh man, you need the right group of people. I've definitely had friends over who were just like, why, you know, what is this and why am I playing it? They couldn't get into kind of like the Play-Doh people physics of it. But man, yeah. you get a certain, anything above, you know, you and one other person who really like clicks with the game, and it's maybe the most fun you can have. It's so good.
It's absolutely hilarious. And so with one of my colleagues, we found out that, you know, this whole physics system, this is also one of these cases of, you know, you're just, here's all you can do, have fun with it. And the fun is also about, you know, getting control of this seemingly uncontrollable physics system. And then we started figuring out that you could actually sort of climb onto stuff if you use the sort of the grabbing and the climbing button. Times and then you could climb into ropes and climb on top of containers or into the trucks, and then basically we just spent like a whole evening just messing around with the physics. We weren't even like playing the game as it was intended. We were just like, okay, let's see if we can get on top of this thing, and then we were just messing around, and that was so much fun. And I love it when this game just provides this sort of sandbox to screw around, and the mechanics are deep enough for you to actually feel like, oh, I'm actually slowly getting better at this. So I've definitely been enjoying Gang Beasts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that game a lot. And it's one of those games that, like Action Hank, that it's been really fun to watch it grow throughout the early access process. I think it's benefited a lot, Gang Beasts, I mean, from having some feedback and seeing how people play it. And I think they have made sort of subtle affordances to the different ways, the climbing thing or whatever, that people want to play that isn't quite what they think. Because I think the original intent was just you rub up against each other and try to throw each other off stuff and that's it. But there's so much more you can do, and it's been really, like, having it develop out in the open, I think, has been really good for the game.
Yeah, and you know, as it already, when they basically launched the very first, like, alpha version or, like, the 0.001 or whatever, like, the first prototype version, you could already see, like, this game already works. So, it's not like it wasn't, like, it was already ready for people to be played back then. So it's, I think definitely early access works well for them because the game is, it's simply like, it works so well already that, you know, you can definitely iterate and there's a million different things you can do, but the game just already works by itself. So yeah, you can hand it out to people, or you can, you know, basically get people involved with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it finds its community, right? Like it's, I think what's smart, because people hate on the early access thing a little bit because some developers use it as a license to release something that's not ready to be released, right? True enough, but things that have a solid core, like Action Hank, like Gang Beasts, you can give a self-selecting group of people who are really, really interested and invested in the idea of it getting better and becoming what it can be involved as early as possible, which seems to me like maybe the best thing for a certain kind of game.
Yeah, no, it's early access is definitely a tricky thing because there's been so much sort of, you know, flame going on about early access, and I mean, it, you know, it makes sense, right? If all these people, they're like, oh, they check out this early access game and they pay money for it, and then it's just like they don't get any updates, or the game is just completely broken, or I mean, there, people have been very disappointed over time. So eventually they just get very wary of it, and that's tricky, because there's also people who try to do it in a proper way and be like, okay, let's, you know, make sure the game already completely functions when we start releasing it on early access, and then sort of just get people involved and actually be able to upgrade the game through the community.
Yeah, I spoke to Zach Barth around the time Infinifactory came out, and he's the guy who made Space Cam and all that, and he felt the need to specifically say, yes, the game is in early access, no, that does not mean it's crap, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that says everything right there.
Yeah. And the game, by the way, was not crap then, and certainly is not now. I don't know if you've played it, but it's pretty cool.
I've heard of it, but I haven't played it.
Yes, I mean, the premise is basically you've been kidnapped by aliens and they're making you solve engineering problems for them. So you have to build these little factories that make stuff out of raw materials in a repeatable way. It's kind of like Space Chem in 3D with kind of a Minecrafty interface. And it's really satisfying. And the most satisfying thing about it is that, as with Action Hank, you beat a level and there are, you know, these kind of bite-sized challenges, and then you can see how your solution rates with other people's solutions. So you solve it and then you try to solve it better. It's equivalent to, you know, trying to get the rainbow medal or whatever. It's really, really well designed.
Cool. Yeah, it sounds good.
Yeah, and you know, like we were saying, it's about as different as a game could be in terms of pace, because it's very kind of deliberate the way you work through a problem, you know, as opposed to, you know, to the right, hold on tight, you know, no matter what, just keep going forward. But yeah, the design sensibility and the satisfaction of it and the way of getting better and of competing with or collaborating with or learning from other players is really similar. So it's kind of an interesting thing to have both of those games coming to fruition at the same time.
Yeah, I see. Even though it probably plays completely different, I assume.
Yes, looks, plays, feels utterly different, but has a lot of the things that make Action Hank work make it work too. So it's kind of a parallel worth making in my estimation. But anyway, if you're looking for a change of pace, it's a pretty cool game.
All right, yeah, I'll write it down. Maybe I can, if I have some time, check it out.
It's funny. I feel like part of what I do on this podcast sometimes is get indie developers into other indie developers' games. which is not a bad thing, but yeah, I was talking to Erin Robinson, who made Gravity Ghost, and talking to her about No Goblin, you know, that new studio, and they made Roundabout, which is a game where you're like driving an endlessly revolving limousine. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, I think I saw that. Yeah, that's a pretty funny premise.
It's pretty cool. It plays kind of like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, in that you're just like in a big semi-open world, you know, doing tricks, but you're starting from this kind of physically nonsensical but weirdly satisfying premise. It's pretty pretty cool. It's
very well done.
Anyway, so that connection's made. So great. I think you're more open than most about the actual process of development, you know, as far as coding goes. You know, you're not everybody sort of lays bare the actual mechanics of how they're making the physics work in the same way you do. And I just wonder if that's because you're hoping to sort of create an environment where everybody's a little more literate in that, and if that's about everybody coding more, or if it's simply about being able to appreciate why the game feels how it feels when you play it, or if that distinction maybe even doesn't make sense to you. You know, why is it that you when you've given talks, that's been the focus?
So basically, let's see. So, well, first of all, obviously, like, I have a very big passion for physics and programming, or like programming games and game physics.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have a chance to talk to people about stuff, I just like to talk about it, because I like the whole thing. So, and also because I put a lot of time and effort into it, and also the way the physics of Action Hank work, but also all the other games that I worked on, I put so much effort and emphasis on the physics that I also hope to be able to, you know, help people out that do not have this sort of focus or experience or passion for the physics. And I'm like, hey, you know, I've been doing this for several years, and I came up with a bunch of tricks, or there's a couple of things that I ran into, and, you know, here's the stuff, so that maybe it can help you out as well. Because if you do it more often, then you start finding these patterns that you see, you know, that you see all the time, So like the whole sort of, I don't know if you've seen anything of me talking about like acceleration and friction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that one where it was like, you know, if speed equals constant, then roll is sad or something like that. Yeah.
So it's basically like there's a couple of these things like that I just keep running into, and I just want to be able to talk to other people that don't have the sort of expertise on this field. It's just, I mean, I just like sharing the knowledge. There's not a much deeper thing to it other than just like, you know, I've ran into these problems and I would like to share them with other people so they don't have to run into them. And then maybe we all get a bit smarter or something. I don't know.
Totally. I mean, the question I'm asking is actually kind of a weird question now that I think about it, because I'm asking like, why do you like talking about a thing you're interested in? That's kind of a strange question, because of course you do. I think maybe it's just, number one, it's relatively rare, you know, not to blow smoke or whatever, but for someone to be as consummate about the programming as you are, and also be sort of as articulate about conveying it as you are, right? Like that's a relatively rare skill set. Just because you're good at doing something doesn't mean you're good at teaching it, you know, for example. But the other thing is, it's just it stands in stark contrast to the kind of secrecy that can happen, you know, about people with their code, or just with tech in general. There's this kind of trade secrets mentality, like we're all hoarding, you know, stuff in a tower. And yeah. I guess I find the way you talk about what you do to be so the opposite of that it can be extremely refreshing.
Oh, wow. That's great to hear. I guess that's the whole point, because the way I talk about these things is also inspired by other people that just sort of explain what they do. And there's no point to be secretive about these things, because, I don't know. It's just, it's way more fun if we can share all this knowledge and then we can help each other out.
So, more fun, more effective. Yeah, and like obviously the open source movement, you know, still exists and all that, but I just feel like it's been waning a little bit, not that it's not vibrant, but just that, you know, a lot of great open source technologies have been acquired by big companies that are slowly but surely making them a bit less open, you know, and that's kind of the direction of things overall, and it's cool to see anything going not in that direction, you know?
So what I think, now that I think of it, I think the reason for me to not like fact that I don't mind being open about all these things is because, especially within like smaller games or indie games, there's not this sense of competition, right? It's more like it feels more like a community than this competition. And that's probably because there's so many small studios that there's no way one studio will sort of like directly influence the other. That doesn't really seem to happen, or at least that's not the way it feels. It feels just like everyone's out there and everyone's, of course, like trying to scream for attention, but it's hard for a studio to actually have significant impact on your sales. But if you look at these big studios, like if you look at, for example, like Call of Duty and Battlefield, or, you know, stuff like PlayStation and Xbox, it's very, you know, realistic that the success of one company will influence the success of the other company. So that's why probably these things are far more secretive. So I guess that's maybe a reason why this whole community is so much more open about these things, or at least it's why I try to be very open about these things, because I don't feel like I'm, you know, like others are a threat. And even if people would go around and sort of, you know, try to copy your stuff and try to, you know, I don't know, I feel like still, you know, the fact that you are the person that's actually talking about these subjects makes me feel like, yeah, that would mean that you are, you know, you should be able to come up with something superior to someone that just tries to copy you. So, I don't know. Yeah. I also don't feel threatened by other people or something, because I feel like, yeah, it's, you just hope to learn something to someone else, not that they just, you know, copy your stuff.
That was, again, you know, when I talked to Zach Barth, he obviously made Infiniminer, which was one of the big inspirations for Minecraft, and Minecraft went on to be one of the biggest things of all time, right? And Zach, as a result, you know, like, I think for a while had kind of a complicated relationship to Minecraft, as his Wikipedia entry states for some weird reason. But he, now, you know, his attitude is very much, well, I made something, and then someone else made something, and now I'm going to make something, and you know, everyone makes the thing that they're able to make, and everyone learns from everybody, and that to me is a very healthy attitude. And I think that, in a certain sense, if Infinity Miner and Minecraft had both been made by you know, rival conglomerates or whatever, that wouldn't be the attitude. That attitude would almost be impossible, you know, given the state of intellectual property law. There would have to be some kind of lawsuit, you know, in somebody's head. Yeah. Not that there would actually have to be, but there would be enough who felt like there did that it would happen, you know?
I see. Yeah, it's tricky. It's always tricky with these creative processes, because it can be that you work on one thing for a year and then, you know, because the problem is that success or sort of, you know, is seems to be very tightly linked to the amount of money that you make on it, or at least in sort of the public opinion. It feels like you're a success if you make money or make a lot of money. So it tends to be tricky, because it can be that you work on this creative thing for a year and then it doesn't make any money, and then you do another thing that you just, you know, mess around and you do it in a couple weeks, and then it can be that you know, become a millionaire from this tiny little thing that wasn't even, you know, didn't even supposed to be something actually serious. So, I mean, look at Goat Simulator.
Sure. Yeah. Something that is, I don't know about intentionally, but out and proud broken, right?
Yes. It's so weird how you just sort of, you try to come up with this, the best ideas, the best design, and everything's perfect. And then you just, you know, and then you just sort of mess this like tiny thing around, or you screw around during a game jam, and then you release it, and then it's like, oh, wow, this just completely blew up. So the tricky thing about doing this creative work is that you must be able to sort of, you know, the fact that you work and the what you, when you make money from it, you have to be able to, you know, completely separate the hours and the money that you make, because of the sort of, normally how you get paid is like you work an hour and then for every hour you get paid a certain amount, and then you work, you know, 40 hours a week and then you get paid this much a month. But if you do this thing where you do your own studio or your own company or like a very creative process, it's absolutely like there's no way linking the work you do and the money that you make. So you must be able to, you know, separate those two, because else you're just going to be like, you're going to get, you know, completely nuts basically.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, if you're in any sense, you know, a sole proprietor or self-employed or anything like that, and you start doing the math of how many hours you put in versus what financial remuneration you've received, you're going to drive yourself nuts. It's not going to work. I mean, at the same time, though, you can't separate them completely, right? Like, if you're making games full time, you've got to make rent. So there's got to be some kind of connection between what you do and what you make, right? Like, it's a hard balance to strike, I think. Because I think it is really healthy to not maybe be mercenary about it and not constantly think of it in terms of, you know, let's do the thing that'll make the most money, because then you're, you know, the Zynga bubble or whatever. But at the same time, like I say, it is a business, right? There's no way around that, you know, until the hypothetical Star Trek future where there's no money.
Yeah, I see. No, it's completely true what you say. It's just, it's tricky because, in the end, you need to make money somehow. So it's all this sort of balance about, you know, how much do I want to do this from a creative, you know, like sort of artistic, you know, standpoint, like, oh, I want to make beautiful stuff and I want to do cool new things and I don't want to be worrying about these money and all that stuff. But then in the end, you have to make money. So somewhere you have to draw a line and be like, okay, we have to do this, or we have to figure out a way to make something that actually sells rather than just something, you know, that's nice or that's really, you know, artsy in any way.
Yeah, well, it's a leap of faith at the end of the day, right? That if you make something honest and authentic and interesting, that it's going to resonate with enough people that it will make money, right? That people will find it, you know, it'll strike enough of a chord with enough people that the financial reward will come.
I hope so.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's, you know, just to be totally candid about it, that's one of the reasons we're here, right? Like, I think it's, I think Action Hank is a game that, well, I know it's a game I really like, and I know it's a game that some of my friends really like, but it's also a game that I know of a lot of people who would really like it, but aren't maybe aware of it, right? And that's after all why we do podcasts, or one of the reasons.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, that's all part of it. And that's definitely what I realized going from, you know, sort of a game development student, or, you know, just a game development starter, to actually becoming this sort of company, like realizing that there's so much more to it than just creating the game. There's so much more to, you know, running a company than just making the game. So, and that's been a very, you know, big challenge and a very big learning process for us.
And that's maybe a structural change worldwide. I mean, to run a podcast or to write freelance is equivalent in a certain sense. in that, you know, it's not like someone gives you an assignment or you pitch something and then you get a certain amount of money per hour or per word or per article or per podcast or per minute of content or whatever. It's just you make stuff, you put it out there, and it's not always entirely clear how or if it'll make money. And yeah, it's healthy in a way, because it's, you know, you're just making stuff you find interesting, and like I said, you know, taking that leap of faith that other people will find it interesting. But it's also scary, and it's, you know, it's insane. From a, I talked to a filmmaker who said that, you know, from a Marxist perspective or whatever, it's nuts that, you know, the people who take on the risk are the artists. You know, that it's, we live in a time when you're expected to come up with your own startup and come up with your own publicity, and all of the onus is kind of on the person making the thing. That's exciting, and it's freeing, and it's liberating, but it's also bizarre, you know?
Yeah, and scary indeed.
I didn't mean to take your very hopeful note and turn it into a bummer right there. That wasn't my intention.
No. It's, I mean, in the end, you just have to, you know, in the end, it's just, it's all, like, you have to be realistic about these things, and it's also a matter of, you know, how far are you willing to go, because it's very simple. There's, you know, a million different people out there that also want to make video games for a living, and not everyone can become a professional, you know, video game maker or game developer. So in the end, you have to be able to separate yourselves, and so that means you have to work hard and be original and all these things, and also just you have to you know, keep going. You have to have a lot of endurance. So I mean, in the end, it's very tough, but it's sort of the price you pay if you want to be able to do something where your passion lies. And that's the only way you will be able to do it. If you, you know, if you don't really like it that much, then you're not going to be able to put all this time and effort in it. So only if you really want to live for it, or only if you really have the passion, then you can actually find the energy, you know, to put all the time in it.
Yeah. One, it's, I mean, and Action Hank, right, just drips with the passion you're talking about, right? It's not so much that a big studio or a big developer couldn't create it, as just that they very, very likely wouldn't, you know? Because it's not a safe bet. It's just something that again, just it comes through as something that the people who made it are passionate about. And that's, I feel like, you know, if we have the leap of faith that people are going to respond to something that's authentic or interesting or connected, I think that's maybe what they're responding to, is that honesty, that clarity, that sense that you know what you like about the games you like, and you feel like you can make something that, you know, again, resonates in those same ways.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I hope so. It's like, you know, we've been in early access for a while now. It's been, I think it was July when we did the early access launch. So it has been like a good, you know, half a year, three quarters of a year now, even more. So yeah, it's really coming together now. It's like almost, you know, everything is almost done, and we're doing wrapping up the final levels, the final characters. You know, we're getting really cool voices coming in, all the final music's coming in, and you can really feel that it's starting to become this final product. And we're definitely like, we're looking at, you know, like our launch window, and we want to be done with the game in about a month or two, and then we want to have the final launch, and then it's like, then it's out there, you know, and then we will see if, you know, enough people will resonate with it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Cool. Well, thank you so much again for taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. Is there anything else maybe about the game or about development that you sort of wish I'd asked, or does that cover pretty well?
No, I think I was already sort of surprised by the sort of the depth of the question. So that was, it's really cool. It's really cool if people ask a bit deeper and ask about more thought behind the game than just, you know, I can do the sales pitch if you want to, but it's just, you know, I did it a lot of times. When you ask these sort of deeper questions, it's way more fun for me, because I can actually talk more about the process behind it. So, like I said,
I'm a giant nerd and a quasi academic. So like asking those kinds of questions is interesting to me. But I'm also a child of the '90s. So, you know, lest I get too full of myself, I did also ask you how many more levels there are going to be, which is maybe the shallowest question you can ask. So I think there's room for both.
Yeah, no, exactly. There has to be a good balance.
Exactly. Yeah, because at the end of the day, like we were saying, right, they're art and they're toys, and there's nothing wrong with that. And art is a stupid word, and I until we have a better one, that's the best I can do. But
like I say, when I play Action Hank, I'm just having a blast and the physics feel good, but I'm also thinking about all sorts of things about, you know, consuming games in the 90s and toys and all kinds of stuff. So it's, like you say, it's as resonant or as deep or as complicated as you're ready for it to be, because it works on a bunch of different levels at once. And that's hard to pull off. And I think you and the team should be commended for pulling it off in my humble estimation.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much.
I really, really appreciate your time, and I can't wait to see the final version of the game, because I've been enjoying it a ton, and I'm going to go try the final challenge right now.
Oh, okay, awesome. Good luck on that.
Thank you. I think I'm going to need it. I appreciate that.
Cool.
All right, have good evening.
Yeah, you too. See ya.
And that's the show. Thanks again to Gould for being here. Sorry again for mispronouncing his name a great many times. You can check out Action Hank on Steam and in the Humble Store. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbay, anywhere where Feedburner and RSS are things. Additionally, if you have a room full of 90s toys and they begin to run races for glory and to establish some sort of pecking order and so on, it'll be cool once you see the full story of Action Hank. But anyway, if you allow them to do that and they award each other rainbow medals for exceptional times on these obstacle courses, the rainbowest of the rainbow medals on the hardest of the hard courses will be a gold LP record containing every episode of this podcast so far, which is, I guess, like 20 hours of material. So, actually, probably that wouldn't fit on one record. This premise is flawed at best. But anyway, you can also, of course, check out all of our ETAO bloggy exploits at etao.wordpress.com. And by the way, one last note, Lucio said in a post not that long ago that we would be doing an episode of the podcast about Telltale's Game of Thrones game. We are still doing that. Just hang tight. Like I said, etao.wordpress.com.
So it's Roel is the way to Roel, yeah, it's Dutch, it's hard.